This is W.W. Chaplin at Allied Supreme Headquarters in Paris. Peace in Europe is now so nearly won that what stands in the way is no longer German strength, but only German stupidity. The European war job of the 12th Army Group, commanded by General Omar Bradley, is evidently almost done. This is the biggest army group on the Western Front, being composed of four armies, the 1st, 3rd, 9th, and 15th. The other two army groups have but two armies. General Bradley's group is also the only one which is all of one nationality. The 21st Army Group has a British army and a Canadian army. The 6th group has one American and one French army. The three armies of the 12th have fought long and to good effect, from the D-Day landings in Normandy by the 1st Army to the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the 3rd. Now its job is not done, but almost done. The D-Day 1st Army really seems to have a chance at last to rest. In its sector, there is no longer enemy resistance. I was with that army in Normandy and during the breakthrough out of Normandy after conquest of Saint-Lô. I well know it deserves any rest it can get after 11 months of ceaseless battle. The 9th Army to the north of the 1st has almost completed its job, too. There are some pockets to clear out. There is still support to be given the British-Canadian forces still further north. Not much else. In the 3rd Army sector, there's a different picture. General Patton's boys are still driving hard into Czechoslovakia, driving toward the Russians who are coming in from the east. But even that isn't a case of fighting as our men have known fighting in the past year. Given choice of surrender to the Russians or to us, the Germans flock to us. I've talked to 9th Air Force flyers who have been cooperating with the 3rd Army ground forces in Czechoslovakia, and they give me a fantastic picture. One of them told me he saw columns of people and vehicles 10 miles long on several roads, all heading west, away from the Russians, toward us. In those columns were both soldiers and civilians, and there were military vehicles sandwiched between farm carts. There were tanks. There were big mobile guns. But when our planes appeared overhead, the enemy armed vehicles did not break out their guns. They broke out white flags. And the tanks were actually loaded down with household furniture, chairs and tables and beds. So our airmen neither bombed nor strafed. They let those columns rush on to surrender. So close is victory. This is W.W. Chaplin, returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Roy Porter, another member of NBC's extensive foreign staff, is waiting now to bring us his story from Paris. So again, we take you to NBC in Paris.
This is Roy Porter at the Allied Supreme Headquarters in Paris. The American 1st Army, which stormed the beaches of Normandy 11 months ago and has been fighting ever since, has at last no one left to fight. Of course, there are patrols and skirmishes and constant reconnaissance. But in the 1st American sector, there is no longer what could be called battle as we have known it. The last big job of the 1st Army was to protect the left flank of General Patton's 3rd for the invasion of Czechoslovakia. The 1st still gives the 3rd cover and backstopping, but it is really in a sort of frontline reserve which gives rest to men who have long needed rest. The 1st Army, then under the command of General Omar Bradley, was the 1st American Army to enter France on D-Day. It also was the only American Army in action during the whole campaign for Cherbourg. It captured Cherbourg and then Saint-Lô alone, though by that time the 3rd Army had arrived in Normandy and was awaiting the call to action. That call came when the breakthrough from Saint-Lô by the American 1st and the British 2nd succeeded beyond all dreams, and every means at our disposal was needed to capitalize on our unexpected success. Since then, the 1st Army has fought in the forefront all the way up through France, at the Battle of the Bastogne Bulge, across the Rhineland, over the Rhine, and into central Germany. until enemy forces disintegrated and enemy resistance collapsed. Under the command of General Courtney Hodges, who succeeded General Bradley when the latter became Army Group Commander, the First Army has built up a reputation that no army of any country can challenge. What may lie in store for the Fighting First, now that its part in winning the European war seems completed, we have not been told. Whether it will remain for a time in Europe, whether it will go home, whether it will be called on for new efforts in the war against the Japanese, we just don't know. But what we do know is this. Based on the accurate measure of past performances, we know that whatever assignment is given to our American First Army, it will be performed with bravery and with patience, and it will be completed with success. This is Roy Porter in Paris, returning you to the NBC Newsroom in New York.
Jim Jensen has been covering the Ninth Army for the National Broadcasting Company, and he's ready now to bring us another up-to-the-minute report. So again, to NBC and Western Europe.
This is Jim Jensen with the Ninth Army in Germany. It was the beginning of the end of the war for the Ninth Army when they first linked up with the Russians. Right now, the Ninth Army is no longer fighting. It is sitting back along the Elbe and receiving German prisoners by the thousands, frightened Nazi soldiers fleeing from the Russians. When the Russians have reached the Elbe all along the Ninth Army front, and that day is fast approaching, fighting on the European continent may well be over for this army. Then the Ninth will probably shift from a fighting force to an occupying force. It will draw back from the Elbe to territory designated for American occupation. The Ninth Army is a comparatively young army, but in its short career, it has made military history. Its first mission last August was to take the vital harbor of Brest and forts along the French coast. Here it met stubborn defense from well-entrenched German forces. Nonetheless, after days of bitter fighting, the fortress of Brest capitulated on September 19th, and the Ninth had won the first of its many brilliant victories. During September, combat troops of the North were dispersed through Brittany and the heart of France. Early in October, a new phase of activity began with an attack on the Siegfried Line, on a front stretching through France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Holland, and Germany. In 2 weeks, the Ninth had reached the River Marne, and on a bitterly cold winter morning, November 16th, began the drive to the Ruhr River. By early December, the Ninth had achieved this objective. Then came the Ardennes offensive when the Germans counterattacked in Luxembourg and in Belgium. The Ninth assumed the defensive in the aid of the First Army and drove the Nazis back. On February 23rd, it began the assault crossing of the flooded Ruhr River. Against stiff enemy resistance, the Ninth reached the Rhine on March 2nd. Still another D-Day for the Ninth came on March 24th when we made the first assault crossing of the Rhine. By the 6th of April, another natural barrier, the Weser River, had been crossed, and on April 13th, the Ninth pushed across the Elbe, the last barrier before Berlin, and this army's phase line. During all this time, the Ninth was fighting on two fronts, 200 miles apart. In the rear, they were crushing the last bit of stubborn resistance in the vital industrial Ruhr Valley, while other elements were surging forward as much as 50 miles a day. The record of the Ninth is one of which every American can be proud. It has always fought against an entrenched enemy, and most often in unfavorable terrain and weather. Yet it has consistently and with lightning speed knocked the fight out of the Nazis, and its contribution to the Allied victory assures it of an honored place in the annals of American military history. This is Jan Gerson with the Ninth Army in Germany returning to NBC in New York.
Again, we return to Supreme Allied Headquarters in Paris for another report on this world at war. Paul Archinard speaking to us direct from Paris.
This is Paul Archinard at Supreme Allied Headquarters in Paris. Today, a whole German army group, two armies, surrendered to our 6th Army Group, composed of our 7th Army and the French 1st. This German Army G group was strung all the way from Linz to the Swiss border from 150 miles. It was the chief opposition the American and French armies still had to face. Surrender of the two new German armies followed by just one day, surrender of another two armies to our 7th Army, and all the armies there were in northwest Germany, Holland, and Denmark to the British. Here are a few other recent 7th Army achievements. In a matter of days, the 7th Army broke into bits of Hitler's vaunted Austrian redoubt, where he boasted his armies would stand until luck turned their way. They broke right into his own chalet at Berchtesgaden, which is reported today to be on fire, though nobody seems to know who started the conflagration. Lurking near the chalet, where they had fled in false hope of safety, were various Hitler henchmen. Two of them are worthy of note, if they aren't worthy of much else. First, there was Gauleiter Max Amann, who was Corporal Hitler's sergeant in the last war, and one of his loudest yes men in later years. The achievement of which he was proudest was that he, as chief of the Nazi party press, published Hitler's Mein Kampf. The other, and even more contemptible prize prisoner at Berchtesgaden, was the infamous Gauleiter Frank, one of whose assignments was extermination of the Polish people. Found hiding in some bushes near Hitler's chalet by 7th Army boys, he admitted he knew about the atrocities in Poland, but he said they were committed without his approval. I guess he didn't think we'd swallow that one, because later he slashed his wrist, tried to take his own life to beat the hangman. He will live for a time. In Frank's house were found $50 million worth of art treasures looted from Poland. There are still little pockets in Austria for the 7th Army to attend to. Not so much real pockets of resistance as just pockets full of Germans, waiting to be emptied at our leisure. This is Paul Archinard returning you to the United States.
Now here's the story from other sectors of this world at war. The Swedish Foreign Office denies rumors of a German surrender in Norway, calls the rumor premature. The enemy Oslo radio quotes a vague sort of statement by Quisling himself. Quisling says his regime must be obeyed until it is replaced to maintain order in Norway. Czechoslovakian quarters in London say there's a patriot uprising in Prague, even though the Germans still fight the Russians on the Czech and Austrian front. All but one German army facing the front, commanded by General Eisenhower, has surrendered. The German 7th Army still faces parts of the American 7th and 3rd on a line from Linz, Austria, to Chemnitz in Germany. That's the latest report on that situation there. American B-29s have attacked an aircraft plant and 17 airfields in southern Japan on their busiest day of the war. General MacArthur and Australian General Blamey are conferring in Manila. In San Francisco, Secretary Stettinius says he has asked Russia to explain the arrest of a group of Polish Democratic leaders. And a Moscow broadcast a short time later said the Poles were arrested by the Soviet military for security reasons, for activities against the Red Army. And that's the War Telescope for today. This afternoon, you've heard from Bjorn Bjornsson, Bill Chaplin, Roy Porter, and Paul Archinard. The War Telescope is a weekly presentation of the NBC News and Special Events Department. This is the National Broadcasting Company.